Hey everybody, this is Jason Tondro, and we are back after a little hiatus with our ongoing developer diary discussing Fly Free or Die, the current adventure path coming out from Paizo and for the Starfinder RPG. I was the lead developer on this adventure path series, and this is a 8-part series in which we are examining every volume of the AP, as well as before work and after work, pre-production and post-production, if you will, and asking kind of how did the adventure get to be the way that it is? What was my job in it? Like, what did I do? And what were my influences? How much did that stuff work? How much did it not work? What can we learn from the adventure and the adventure path in general? And what are the lessons that we can take kind of going forward? As even now, I'm contemplating the next adventure path I'm going to do. A little bit of background. We have been remiss in this series for a couple of months. From January through the end of March, I was head down on a couple of big Paizo writing projects. First, I wrote Starfinder Adventure Path Volume 43, I think. Which is part of the Horizons of the Vast series. I had, and then the second project that I was writing is a volume for the Quest for the Frozen Flame adventure path, which has a product page on the Paizo website, but about which almost nothing has been said. So I can't get into details on that one, but when we talk about lessons learned, I had these. I went to both Keeley and Patrick Rennie, the developer on the Frozen Flame AP. And as writers, freelance writers often do, we sort of solicit, like, hey, do you have anything that you need written? Or I say to Patrick, hey, I heard that you're developing a new adventure path. I would love to write for you, right? And you kind of have to put your name forward. You have to, if you want to get the gig, you have to ask for the gig, right? As a long-standing freelancer lesson. And it's totally true. You have to ask for the gig if you want to get the gig. Well, anyway, well, Patrick and Keeley were both very kind, and they did. They had work for me, except that the deadlines were like the same week. I had two Adventure Path volumes to write for a total combined assignment of about 85,000 words. And they were all due basically the end of March. And so that meant a serious examination of my work schedule and figuring out how to get all that stuff done on time. Now, I'm going into all this because some of you are freelancers or even from the developer side, and you might find some of this information helpful. So the first thing I did was I communicated with my developers. I talked to both of them and I said, listen, here's my situation. I can write these things for you and you will get them. But I want you to know that I'm doing two big projects at the same time, and I'm not going to be able to efficiently go back and forth between them. Like, I can't do like Keeley's milestone and then Patrick's milestone and then Keeley's turnover and Patrick's turnover, and like, going back and forth on the two projects like that would drive me crazy. I need to be able to focus on one project at a time. So since Keeley's is shorter, I'm going to do Keeley's entirely first. So I'm like, okay, Keeley, you're going to get your entire adventure basically 2 months early. I'm going to finish it by the end of January, basically when the milestone was due. I'll get, once again, a brief reminder of kind of a vocabulary here. The milestone is, as a developer at Paizo, that's what I'm looking for about halfway through the assignment. When you show me where you are at the moment and you've got like maybe half the adventure done or so, like, it kind of depends, everybody works differently, but we're looking for basically a check-in where you show me everything you've got and I can course correct anything or ask you to make any changes. And also, if you have not gotten anywhere on it, I know that, and we can start talking about emergency solutions, right? If you have not gotten to where you need to get. So anyway, so I said to Keeley, like, okay, I'm going to turn the entire thing in by the milestone. And I wrote the entirety of Starfinder 43 in about 3 weeks, from January 7th, I think is when I started, maybe 6th, to the end of January. And, you know, you just sit down and you do like 1500 words a day or whatever. And on the weekends, you can catch ahead if you fall behind on the weekdays. And I had to bribe myself. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever had like that much work you've had to do in that short of a time, but I had about 35,000 word assignment added all up between the adventure and the back matter articles and the new monsters and new starship and everything that I was doing for that adventure. And it's really great, by the way. It's a swarm focused adventure. And I have been dying to write a swarm adventure basically since I discovered Starfinder. And I came in too late to work on Attack of the Swarm. But I really kind of have very strong feelings about what swarm adventures should feel like. Like I want them to be a certain kind of encounters. Like, for example, every encounter in a swarm adventure should either be tons of low-level mooks, right? So there's like 12 bad guys on the map, or one huge boss that's going to kill all of you, right? Like, it should be one or the other. And I wanted to do all kinds of I wanted to get into a swarm environment. Like, what does it feel like to move around in a swarm starship or a swarm space station? And Keeley's outline for 43 gave me everything I wanted to do. So that was really great. And I pitched him some ideas and he was totally great with them. And I was very happy with how it happened, but it all happened really fast. Then meanwhile, I'm talking to Patrick and I'm like, okay, I know you need a milestone. I'm not going to have it because I'm busy writing this other adventure. It's going to be late, but you know, so it's all about communication here, folks. The lesson is communication. And also because both of these developers knew that I could deliver. I mean, that's why they came to me in the first place, because they knew that I could turn in stuff on time and on a short time schedule. So they weren't too worried about it, frankly, because they knew that I had, you know, I'd written Pathfinder Adventures and Starfinder Adventures before, and they weren't really worried that I would be able to deliver. So anyway, then after I turned in everything for Keeley on the end of January, I turned to the Pathfinder adventure. Now, the Pathfinder adventure, I was writing literally the entire book, the entire adventure, all the back matter material, all the NPC specials that get called out with two-page spreads, the new monsters, everything in it, the entire book cover to cover is the Tondro jaunt, right? So, and I guess this is how they're doing it on Pathfinder side now. Like this happens pretty fairly frequently, I think now. So that all added up to like 55,000 words, right? Almost like 52 and a half or something crazy like that. Well, so I started it essentially February 2nd or February 3rd. I think I took a couple of days off and then I dove right into it. Well, I needed to finish. I think my original turnover date was March 15th. And Patrick graciously gave me another couple of weeks, so it would be March 30th. And my milestone was late as well. But what I was able to do was finish the first third of the adventure. Like the whole, and in many ways, that early part of an adventure is the hardest because you want to get the player characters involved. You need to show that you need to set the tone and kind of set the whole feel for the adventure. And so I was able to work through all of that and give Patrick a complete and fairly done first act of three. Now, of course, he had a lot of changes because that's what milestones are for, but they were mostly organizational, right? Like, okay, you know, like you've got all these encounters and events, like why don't you, like, rather than trying to do them or rather than organize them the way that you did, let's do this other organization that I think might be more intuitive and maybe help the GM better understand the book that they're reading. And I'm like, great, sure, let's do that, right? And I kept in communication with Patrick the entire time and was able to deliver everything mostly on time. I think April 3rd or 4th is when I turned in the last of the maps, right? Because I had to redraw some maps and get all that stuff done. 87,000 words in 3 months, never do that. Right. Now it's important to remember that writing a game material is not like writing fiction or writing screenplays or writing anything else, right? Like you could knock out and you can knock out an 87-page screenplay in a long weekend. But knocking out 87,000-word RPG adventures takes a different kind of stamina and scheduling. Some of those words go really fast. When you're writing lore, background material on a settlement, for example, or even when you're just describing an encounters, you know, like if you know what, if you've got a dungeon map and you have a pretty good idea of what is in every area, like that thing is fun as shit to write. Like I would just get in and I would just start writing encounters and I will flesh out this dungeon room by room as I imagine the players crawling through it, and it goes so fast. But then other parts are way labor intensive, like figuring out treasure and figuring out XP and writing up stat blocks. And these things just take time, man. And a lot of it's not creative time. It's editorial and development time. Like your stat block has to be in the right structure and format. And we have a way that stat blocks are written, and it's a pain in the ass, but it there's a reason for that format. And assembling all of that stuff takes time. Now, there's a lot of tools to make that time go faster, and I encourage you to use them. But, you know, ultimately, some of this writing goes faster than others. So I say all this because I think sometimes as writers, we can get into kind of a how many words did you write per day kind of trap. And it's important to remember that all words are not equal. And just because you put 1,000 words down on paper doesn't mean that they were, that doesn't give them equal value to the 200 words that you spent the next day because you spent 2 hours working on a stat block. There's a lot of advice that we could give about writing and about the writing process, but I want to point everybody towards Chuck Wendig's wonderful gentle writing advice blog entries and his Twitter threads. That, you know, that sometimes writing is hard, and every project is kind of its own beast, you know. And I have found that on some writing projects, I'm able to enter it very quickly by doing something like making up all the stat blocks or figuring out all the encounters and the XP and the treasure. And another adventure, I might have to start at the beginning. I have to start writing the text, like the very first encounter, how does it open? Or what is the background information? I write the adventure synopsis first, and I just start writing and I kind of find my way in. Or maybe there's a cool key encounter, like for this Starfinder adventure, I knew I had to have this orbital drop encounter. The player characters are in a starship and they're trying to land on a space station, on a station that's orbiting a planet. And so they drop down, basically a terminal velocity orbital drop. And I knew I wanted to try some new mechanics for that. Like I wanted to have kind of a little orbital drop subsystem kind of mechanics thing. And that meant I had to play test it because I made up some rules. And I've got all the swarm creatures that are like flying up at you as you're falling at terminal velocity. And then, of course, you fly right through the cloud of them. So then they all have to turn around and try and catch you as more of them are coming up from the ground. So you're like, and there's some black flying up from the bottom. There's some flying up to you from the top. And there's all this kind of, but how do I resolve that? Like, you can't just hit the ground and go splat, right? Like, how does it end? And how, you know, how do I do that? Well, so I figured it out. I figured out a system, and then I play tested. I took 4 iconics and I played through my version of the orbital drop scenario and recorded everything. And then I included the whole play test with the subsystem when I sent it to Keeley so that he could see that I wasn't just pulling this whole thing out of my ass, right? Anyway, so there's different ways into every project. Every project is different. Don't punish yourself. I took a lot of breaks when I was doing all that. Like you think, okay, 1,000 words a day, sit yourself down. It wasn't like that. I did write about 90,000 words in about 90 days, but there were, like, I took a long week off, right, once in a while to just kind of do my own thing. I bought a PS5 in the middle of that, and, you know, Miles Morales Spider-Man is a pretty damn good game, and so I was, like, taking time off, and I was playing. Now, thank God the game is short, right? Able to work all the way through it in about a week and a couple of days, but when you know that you are capable of doing 6,000 words a day on a weekend. And you can crank through 10,000 words in a weekend if you need to, which is what I did on 43. Like I was working. And then I was like, okay, I need 12,000 words and I'm 2 days from deadline. So now it's time to just crack the whip and get this thing done. As Ron Lundeen puts it, an adventure is never done. It's just due. If you had another week, another month, you would put more time into this and it would be better. But there comes a time when you have to hand it over to the developer and the editors and you have to let them do their job. And this is not irrelevant to our actual official topic for the day because, you know, writing adventures for Fly Free or Die is a challenge. Like these are hard projects and the outlines were often very vague or alternatively too ambitious. They asked you to do very hard things or they left a lot of the adventure kind of up in the air for the writer to decide what to do. And that's not always good. As a writer, when you get an outline that gives you a lot of leeway, well, for some writers, that's good because they want a lot of leeway. But for other writers who maybe do better with a lot of structure, a vague outline is not helpful. It can be a problem. And when I wrote the outline for Professional Courtesy, I had a lot of like, okay, players start at A and somehow they get to D and how they get from A to D, I don't know. And this created, I think, a lot of challenges in the sense that, you know, like, well, I as a developer could have been more helpful to the writer. I could have said, okay, here's a list of some of the encounters I want to see. Because Starfinder is a very mechanical driven game. Like player characters advance based on XP and they get XP by having encounters. And they have to advance two levels in the adventure, in this case from levels 5 to 7, I think. Yeah, levels 5 to 7. And they, which means they have to get a certain amount of XP along the course of the adventure. And if the developer doesn't tell the writer how that XP is acquired, it can feel like, well, the adventure just starts to come in a little thin. Right, like there's just not enough shit going on, and the player characters won't advance at high enough level to hit their milestone, hit the target by the end of the adventure, and that's bad. So, one of the things I learned now, the Fly Free or Die outline was my first extended outline for an AP, and I think that in the future, and I've actually already kind of been able to implement this a little bit because I've been writing outlines for our module line and our one-shot line since I did Fly Free or Die, that I've been able to kind of dig in a little bit more and get more details out and maybe help give the writer more tools about the kinds of encounters that the players might have in each section of the adventure so that the writer can say, okay, I'll take these ideas and I still can add some more, but I don't feel like I have to invent everything, right? Like I have to do all the encounters myself. Let's give the, as a developer, I want to give the writer a little bit more structure, a little bit more scaffolding, as to use the old academic term we used to use. Like when a writer comes into the classroom and they're where they are as a writer and where they want to be to get from A to B, they need a lot of sort of scaffolding. They need a lot of help to get there. Now that's, I don't want to overemphasize that metaphor in this because my writers are very talented. They don't need any help learning how to be good writers. But the structure of the adventure often needs a bit more detail in the outline than I originally gave them in the original Fly Free or Die outline. But that's all part of the lessons learned. Let's talk about Professional Courtesy. This adventure is a straight up Abyss homage. Like I've talked about before that Fly Free or Die in many ways is a gigantic James Cameron movie. Cameron's most famous for films like Terminator and Aliens and Avatar, Titanic. But all of his films have this kind of working class hero mentality going on. And there's often a class war that's visible in the background. So you've got characters who are rich and characters who are poor, and the characters who are poor are the heroes. And their struggle, their social struggle, is part of their heroic struggle. That is to say, they are more heroic because they are short on means. They're poor, and we like them better. We root for them more because they are poor. This was part of the DNA of Fly Free or Die. But I also wanted to acknowledge kind of my favorite films of Cameron's oeuvre, and one of those is The Abyss. If you have not seen this film, it is a really, really interesting picture, and you are in for a treat. I really recommend the director's cut. There's a lot of there's a long discussion and conversation to be had about how that movie evolved from its original film director's version to how it was released. The short version is that it was about 40 minutes too long. Nowadays, we watch Zack Snyder's 4-hour Snyder cut, and we that's just part of the deal now. Like, we're used to movies that are 2.5 or 3 hours long. Lord of the Rings, you know, is 4 hours long and it's directed extended editions. But when Cameron did The Abyss, movies that long were not commercially viable. Like, nobody did that. And so Cameron, he makes this movie, which has a lot of plots going on, but the main plot is kind of this romantic reunification between two estranged characters who have been married but then divorce and then come back together over the course of the adventure in the film. They remember their love for each other and in great trial and great struggle. Meanwhile, there's this like big macro scale plot going on where the world is getting close to nuclear tensions and there's threats of nuclear war and the whole world is kind of spiraling out of control. And it ends in this really fantastic special effects sequence that kind of that resolves the global threat. Well, you can imagine which of these two plots the studio wanted Cameron to cut, right? They wanted to cut the romance, right? Like, keep the big special effects thing. This is a summer blockbuster movie. Like, that's the money shot right there. Like, you need to keep, but of course he cut that part. When I've talked about development, I've mentioned this lesson from Cameron, and I learned that lesson from this movie by Cameron. When your movie is too long, when your adventure is too long, when your project, your book is too long and you have to cut it, don't try to cut little tiny snippets out of the whole thing. Don't try and cut 10 seconds, 15 seconds, a sentence, couple of sentences. Don't try and nickel and dime your project because you'll just kill it with 1,000 cuts. Instead, find one big chunk and take the whole chunk out entirely. And that allows you to leave the rest of the adventure pretty much as it was written. And then you just take this big piece out, and maybe you get to use that piece again later, maybe you don't. But the rest of your project stays alive in its essentially original form. So he cut the entire global subplot out of the film, and it puts it back in for the director's cut. And it's really, really interesting. In addition, the film's got Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and this great kind of like crew of basically space underwater truckers. Like, this is sort of like the Armageddon film, except way earlier and way better, right? Like, you've got these sort of working class heroes who are in an underwater mine, underwater drill, and they're drilling for oil or something on their oil drillers, but they work deep, deep, deep underwater in this experimental underwater oil rig. And And the characters are just so wonderfully characterized. Like, they have fantastic personalities. And if you've seen Aliens, you know that Cameron can do this. Like, when you think about all the Marines waking up in the in their life pods at the beginning of Aliens, and they have one sentence each, and you know everything you need to know about them, right? Like, Vasquez, have you ever been mistaken for a man? No, have you? Like, those two lines tell you everything you need to know about those characters, right? Hudson and Vasquez. Well, the same thing kind of happens in The Abyss. But it's also an underwater film. Cameron is a fascinated slash obsessed with underwater action and underwater films. He pioneered a lot of high technology for The Abyss. He would bring all the stuff back and do it bigger and badder in Titanic. And the future Abyss films have long underwater sequences as well. So anyway, all of this is a very long prelude. When I was assigning the adventures for Fly Free or Die, and I had originally asked someone else to do this volume, someone who had never written for an Adventure Path volume for Starfinder before. They had written for Starfinder, but not an Adventure Path. And I wanted to give that chance to as many new writers as I could. I was a new developer. I felt incredibly lucky to be working on this. So I wanted to give other people, I wanted to share the love. Let's spread it around a little bit. I could use all the karma I can get, right? But I just didn't hear back in time. Like, I had to have these things assigned, and I didn't hear back. Sometimes communication channels can be difficult. And, you know, we live in a online age, and email addresses go stale. And, you know, you do your best to contact them, but if you can't reach them, you can't reach them. And Joe, meanwhile, had said, listen, he had done what I was talking about earlier when I went to Patrick and Keeley. He had said, listen, I'm looking for freelancing work. If you have any assignment that's available, I'd be interested. He knew that I was assigning an Adventure Path. Well, I love Joe's adventure. Joe wrote the second volume of Dawn of Flame, which it's got this really innovative starship that the players get that plunges down into the sun. It's built like a pine cone. It's fantastic. He's got this cool like casino, extended casino sequence where the player characters get in all these mini games, like a, you know, gambling mini games, and it's just really well written. It's a wonderful story, and I liked it a lot. And I'd told him that before. Like, he knew that I really liked this adventure. So I said, well, listen, you're going to be my backup guy. If any of my writers don't come through, I'll come to you. And he was like, great. Well, that's exactly what happened. So I needed a writer for volume three. And I was very confident giving it to Joe. I mean, he's the lead designer for the game, right? Like, talk about a safe space. As a developer, like, I was giving a lot of adventures to people that were relatively, that had not written a lot of material for Starfinder before. Like, maybe they had done a Starfinder scenario, a 10,000 word scenario for organized play, but they had never done a Starfinder adventure before, not a 25,000 word adventure path. And so it's a big deal. You know, it's a bigger assignment. It's a lot of risk. And this, I was advised to, you know, hire people that you were not going to have to do a lot of work to develop, right? And Joe is one of those people. So it probably worked out for the best that I had a lot of writers who were more experienced and knew Paizo from the inside and were able to do this. The cover turned out great. I want to talk about the cover a little bit because there was some ongoing conversations amongst the creators about the covers, and they kind of eventually landed on this one. The Paizo Adventure Paths have a form. They have a format in terms of how the cover looks. There's always a behind the character image, right? In this case, we've got this fantastic underwater combat sequence with these Kalo mercenaries, and I love their suits in this cover shot. Like, this Kieran, the editor lead for this project, calls this adventure the water level, and it's totally the water level. But I dig that stuff. Like, I had my memories of like aquatic combat rules going all the way back to Dragon magazine, you know, like that every game has these unique underwater combat rules and an adventure that spotlights them, and you do all this adventuring underwater. And I wanted to, it seemed like a great opportunity. So anyway, to do something different where the player characters were exploring a new environment, but they were also doing it in a way that was different than what they would normally expect. But let's talk about Dragon, Avarin here. All of the writers on Fly Free or Die, both the adventures and the adventure and the back matter, were all invited to a Discord server where we could all talk to each other, and we could brainstorm ideas, and we could talk back and forth about the adventure and about people's writing and what they were doing. And also I could post like a bunch of commonly used reference documents up there, and here's the style guide, and, you know, here's an outline of the adventure path. And, you know, it was just kind of a common sort of home base for people to access. Well, I was, we were moving along on this, and one of the writers noted that, you know, could we take a look at these covers again and ask ourselves about gender representation? Because, like, there's lots of dudes on the covers of these books, and it would be nice if we could get some non-dude representation on the covers. Some of this was because of the iconics I ended up using. My favorite iconics are not the iconics that are used in this adventure. But that's because almost all of my favorite iconics had been the key iconics of the previous adventure path. And so I felt like I couldn't use them over again. Okay, so number one lesson, no. Like, if I want to use Raya and our iconic envoy, I can use them. I don't have to, just because they got used in the previous adventure path, doesn't mean I can't use them again. So the four iconics that are part of this adventure path are the Ahsoki mechanic, Valero, the vanguard, Dr. B, the biohacker, whom I love, and Isif, the android operative. Now, B is female, and Isif is asexual, gender neutral, essentially. And the other two characters are male. And then as we talked about the covers, like this writer had sort of pointed out to me, like, well, you know, it's mostly dudes and we don't have a lot of female representation. Well, the challenge here is that, of course, the covers had already been described, which means I had already written art orders for them. So I had written up what the covers were all going to be like, and I'd already submitted those art orders to our art department to get those covers illustrated. Well, but they had not yet been assigned. Like, I could go in and I could make changes, and even though I had already submitted the art order, those covers had not yet been actually illustrated yet, and the artist had not been hired yet. So I could make changes kind of on the side and still in time. So we had some conversations and we talked about, like, well, you know, like, what can we really do? I thought it was okay. Like, you know, we have the captain of the Wintermourne, Neva, on the cover of volume 2. We had the Drow Assassin on the cover of volume 1. And of course we have Aline Rasora on the cover of volume 5. But because the iconics were loaded male, we felt like maybe we could do better. So we talked about it back and forth and we decided to change Avarin to a female character. And we had this long conversation, like, well, can you even really tell? Like, Avarin's a dragon. Will you even be able to tell? Gang, I can't tell. But it's a thought that counts. So now we have more women on the cover, more female characters on the cover, because we made Avarin female. And, like, well, you know, the end result of a long conversation. But the real end result of that was carrying that lesson forward. So when we do the next AP, I can pick an iconic group that's more gender balanced, and less macho, and I can let that guide me instead of not using characters that we've used in the previous adventure path. Also, I want to note that when your writers start talking about your cover decisions, it can be very easy to get very defensive about that. People are saying, well, like, you know, but they're basically telling you, like, you did the covers wrong. And okay, it can be very easy to get very defensive about the choices that you made. And I found it very useful to just keep my mouth shut and let the women on the channel talk and kind of talk about this issue amongst themselves and wait until they had come to kind of a consensus agreement. And then I could take that agreement and decide if I could or should change anything. Rather than me getting into the channel and like debating whether or not these women felt underrepresented, like, okay, that's not how this works. Like, that's not a productive use of my time or a productive way to contribute to the conversation. That's, don't do that. So instead, I just kind of, I let that conversation play out and then took that advice as sincere and heartfelt from writers who wanted to make the project better and then tried to find a way to do it within the limited constraints that we had. Like, I couldn't really change a lot of characters' genders. I couldn't swap out an iconic because I'd already used them. You know, like the first cover was already, the art for the first issue was already being done. And I was locked into those, right? So anyway, listen to your writers, appreciate their point of view. Don't argue and fight with them on these issues when you don't have any standing. I mean, I'm the white dude, right? Like the aging white dude. I need to shut up and listen. And so you do that. You shut up and you listen, and then you see how you can improve the project within the restraints that are still available to you, right? Because as time moves on, your what you can do becomes narrower and narrower and narrower until finally by the end you can't do anything, like it's done. Okay, as is our wont, we're going to talk about the back matter and stuff first before we get into the adventure. We've got three side jobs in this. The side jobs have been a very lucrative, I think, field for us. We learned a lot working on them. These are just sort of two page adventure spreads, right? With like one stat block or a map that helps a GM run a one night adventure based on the events. And I think originally, there was some concern that we would create these side jobs in case the players somehow fell behind in terms of XP or build points. Remember that in this adventure, the way your starship improves is different than in a traditional Starfinder game. In a regular Starfinder adventure, every time your group levels up, you get a bunch of build points and you can improve your starship. And the way that you acquire those build points is kind of hand-waved. It's left to the GM to figure out the story for that. Like, okay, so now we get to add a laser cannon to our starship, or all of our hull points get big, stronger, or whatever. And how do we get to do that? Well, there's normally a spot in the adventure where we just say, you are able to refit your starship. But how you got the stuff to actually refit it, we don't really get into, you know, like we kind of let the players figure that out. Well, in Fly Free or Die, those build points as a major currency, and you're going on missions. You're carrying cargo from planet to planet, trying to buy low, sell high. And what you buy and sell that cargo with is build points. And I think there was some concern on the team that because the system was not guaranteed, it was not certain that you would get enough build points to go up in level, your characters might find their starship falling behind in power, and you would end up not being able to complete the starship challenges that the adventure presumes you can complete because you've missed out on a bunch of build points as you leveled up. So we created these side jobs as a way for the GM to give the player characters a bunch of build points by carrying cargo and doing jobs. And that would get them back up to the level they needed to be at. Now, I don't think that's actually a problem, but if the result is a bunch of like two-page plot hooks that players and GMs can run in a one-shot Night of Starfinder, that's all win. Like the result is good, even if we probably didn't need them. We're working on new projects in Starfinder, and there's more of these kind of two-page side job style of adventures coming in future projects, which we haven't announced yet. And I was able, when we talked about how to do that, I could point to the side job stuff, and Keeley developed all the side jobs. And I could point to the side job stuff and could say, like, we've done this. We have a model, and it's not exact. You might not want to do exactly what we did there, but you can kind of use that as something to build off of. And that's made them very successful. And I like that. It's a new format. It's a format that allows players and GM. It gives the GMs what they need: a map, a new starship, a stat block, or whatever. And it's kind of an adventure, a one night's adventure in two pages. And I dig that. Joe wrote my underwater combat essay for this. Now, originally, what my intent had been here, just kind of focus on water magic. We have that big section of the element on the plane of fire, and I think Starfinder 18, Assault on the Crucible, which has got a bunch of fire spells, and it's got like a fire connection for the mystic, and it's got a bunch of other, you know, plane of fire related stuff. And I think I was thinking of something kind of like that, but Joe suggested, well, what if we like assemble all of the rules on aquatic combat and aquatic adventuring and bring them all together and then add additional new stuff that players can use while adventuring underwater? And I was like, dude, if this means you can give me a seahorse that player characters can ride underwater, I'm in. Because, you know, Aquaman has always been my favorite super friend. So, he totally delivered. Like there is a bunch of water magic. There's a bunch of spells related to water that you can use underwater, because water, you don't just want water spells. You also need just spells that work underwater. Your fire spells don't work as well, right? Lots of magic doesn't work as well underwater. So what can you get instead that won't be affected or might even work better underwater, right? And then there's, you know, water vehicles and water gear and all kinds of stuff. And also a recap and a synopsis and expansion of the underwater combat rules, which are, you know, the basics are in the core rule book, but there's a lot of, there wasn't really room there to get into all the details that we might want. So the aquatic chapter, the aquatic rules turn out quite good, aquatic adventures. In fact, it made me think that if we ever get a chance, I would love to reproduce this whole underwater adventuring section in a regular rule book, like a hardback rule book. Maybe it got into GEM. Maybe it got into the Galaxy Exploration Manual. I don't know. New feats, new gear, new spells, all kinds of stuff for underwater adventures. Not very well. The Alien Archive. So the big things here is, and when we think of underwater adventure in science fiction, there's kind of some famous scenes. I mean, I think of The Abyss, but most of our fans, when they think of it, they think of stuff like Phantom Menace, that the famous, there's always a bigger fish sequence in Phantom Menace when they're getting chased by a sea monster who then gets eaten by a bigger sea monster. And so Joe kind of ran with that. You know, he created two different versions of giant sea monsters, one of which is even bigger than the other, so that we could have a there's always a bigger fish moment. And there's totally that scene. It's a straight up Star Wars homage moment comes in this adventure. But more importantly, what was really most of the work in terms of that creative work was the Aglians. So the premise of this adventure is that Tarika, who is the player character's contact, and we'll talk about the adventure and kind of how it got all this way, what I was trying to do. Tarika has a daughter. Her name is Shan. And Shan is a mechanic oil rigger on this remote planet. She works as a terraformer on this water world that is being terraformed into a habitable paradise by EdgeCorp. And but what she has discovered is that there is a native life on this planet, and the I think I was originally going to name it Kraken or something. I'm a big fan of like naming things after classic fantasy monsters. Like, it seemed to me something people would do. Like, if you're in a universe where the Kraken exists, then you're going to name a water world Kraken. I think Joe thought it was a little bit too derivative, and he wanted to make it less fantasy-ish, less D&D-ish, and more Starfinder-y, and that meant giving it a Starfinder-y name. And I'm like, great, that's cool. Whatever you want to do. So we created Entha, and the natives of Entha, I think I came up with this idea. It's been a while now. Essentially are a kind of aggregate species. So like one individual Aglian, and Joe named them, one individual Aglian is not sapient. It does not have human intelligence. But if you get a bunch of them all together, they sort of form this collective mind. It's different than the Brethidens, right? It's different than we have collective species in Starfinder already that kind of all can lump themselves together to form a giant collective mind. These guys are different in the sense that they kind of need to be working all together in order to be sapient. But it also means that they still have that aspect where some of them can leave and join other groups. And so, and Joe came up with this interesting idea of sort of comparing them to neurons. So one individual Aglian is like a neuron, but if you get enough of them together, they're like a brain. That's good. Let's do that. And he came up with this great mechanic for them. Trust Joe to come up with cool game mechanics that where you pick, like he gave a list of nouns, like of emotions, love, hate, fear, envy, curiosity. And then every one of these nouns has a game effect, like a stat block mechanic, like, you know, increases your speed or gives you damage resistance or makes you go berserk or whatever. And then when you meet an Aglian, you can just put together three of these nouns and have a new Aglian. And it's got traits in common with other Aglians, but it's unique because of its unique three-word combination. It's a wonderfully elegant way of showing how Aglians are components, but they are also unique in their whole. And all of that is represented in game mechanics. So they have the three-word combo has specific rules effects. So lovely design. I loved how they turned out. The Aglians are great. I totally dig them. You're not going to be playing one because you'd have to play 100 Aglians in a giant fishbowl. But, you know, somebody out there is now trying to make their Aglian character and playing a giant fishbowl filled with 100 Aglians. So like, more power to you. Aglian, the Aglian operative. Let's see it. Okay. So let's talk about the adventure itself and kind of what we were going for and how it fits in. So think about, let's rewind a little bit and talk about the overall outline of the whole AP. The first adventure, We're No Heroes, is about the player characters working for EdgeCorp and hating it and breaking out on their own and stealing their starship at the end, right? Like, it's all about working for the man. Then they get their starship at the end and they spend the whole second volume, Merchants of the Void, and we already done our show about that last time, so just rewind and watch that. Leo Glass's wonderful adventure, in which the player characters travel from planet to planet doing jobs, and it's very picaresque in the sense that you've got like a new adventure, a new job all the time, and every job takes you to a new planet. Now, Leo wisely built this overarching plot line in there so that there is a satisfying conclusion to it, a very cinematic, climactic finale. But the overall structure, while you're playing it, feels like, oh, this is Thursday, so this must be the best two. Like, you're on a new planet every mission. But you're also sort of getting, you're the second volume is the purest version of what this whole AP is about, which is that kind of serenity traveler, new planet, new job, adventure of the planet of the week kind of campaigning. For the third adventure, I felt like we had to mix it up. I can't just do more of that. I can't just do more Planet of the Week campaign. Like, it should be different. Also, there's a big part of this campaign is asking the players and their characters, what's your motivation? Why are you doing the things you're doing? Is it really for the money? Are you really just in this for the money? Or is there some moral and ethical issue here? I've been thinking a lot about Ocean's 11. And there's this scene where Rusty is talking to Ocean, and he's saying, "Look, like, tell me why are we doing this, and don't tell me it's about the money. These are two thieves. These are two professional con artists." And Rusty's point is like, we're not doing this for the money. We're doing this for some noble purpose. We're not just criminals. We're not just greedy thieves. We're heroes. We don't call ourselves heroes, and we don't like to be called that, but we are. So this comes a moment. This is a moment where the player characters, I wanted to have them doing something that wasn't for the money. And so that's why it's called professional courtesy, because Tarika comes to the players and says, "Look, I need a favor." This is a classic bit. Like, every adventure television show has this. When I was a kid growing up, it was a Magnum PI thing. Like, Magnum, there's Tom Selleck, Magnum PI in his Hawaiian shirt. And some guy would come up to him, and he would be an old Vietnam buddy from Magnum's past in Vietnam, and be like, "You know, Magnum, I need you to do this for me. Like, can you help me?" But this is not unique to that show. It's a pretty basic staple. It's the call to adventure. Somebody is in trouble, and they need help. They can't solve this by themselves. And they come to the players, they come to the heroes, and they say, "Will you help us?" And you don't get anything out of it. They are not paying you. You expect no reward. Now, meta-wise, it's an RPG, and you know that I have to get treasure to level up. And so as a player, you might know that there's probably going to be treasure in this adventure, and you're probably going to get something out of it. You're going to get XP. You're going to level up. But as a character, the character has no promise or expectation of reward. Will you still do the job? Will you help this person? And it's Tarika, because she's helped you. Like, for two volumes, Tarika has been helping you out, right? She's put her own money up there. She's got skin in the game. And when you quit EdgeCorp, she quit EdgeCorp. And like, Tarika should be a pretty... And a couple of the player characters might have connections to her from the player's guide. Like, maybe they worked with her in earlier years, or they know Shan because, like, they remember when Tarika was raising Shan as a single mom, and she had to take days off from work to be with her daughter, and you covered for her because that's what friends do, right? Well, so now Tarika comes to you and says, "I need help. Shan is dropped out of contact. She's off on this remote planet. She last time I heard from her, she was saying that things were looking pretty shady, and she thought that there was something wrong here, that something bad was happening. And then her communication stopped. Will you go to this planet, find her, and if she's in trouble, get her out?" Well, because it's a Starfighter adventure path, we have to have what happens if the players say no, right? What if they say, "No, I'm not doing it without being paid"? Well, okay, so Tarika has some money. She offers you some minor sum, but it's all she's got, right? And this is just one of many moral and ethical moments in the whole adventure path where the player characters are pressed to decide what they really believe in and who they really are. This adventure is also interesting in that it literally picks up right where the previous one leaves off. the players are, I think, on like some hobgoblin planet or in I forget where they are at the end of volume two. And we wanted to get them back to Absalom Station to meet with Tarika, but I think Joe was a little worried that they wouldn't have enough build points. So he wanted to add some encounters and give them a job that they could do to go back to Absalom Station, which would get them some build points. And so we kind of expanded this together, and we built in several early encounters, which maybe feel like a prelude, or maybe like they're not part of the main story, but I think it worked out okay. It's still a bit, it's kind of a trailing edge of that picaresque, it's a new day, so it must be a new planet, it's a new job, kind of aspect of Merchants of the Void. So you still get to do a little bit of that in this adventure, which serves as an interesting contrast to when Tarika finally meets you and you get this bid, you get this request. It gave us a chance for some starship action and a boarding. It could either be starship combat or a boarding action, or maybe the players just make a deal or run for it. And that kind of like anticipating multiple ways that an encounter could go and giving the GM the tools to do it in more than one way is good. It reinforces the idea of player choice and making it so that the adventure isn't too railroady, right? But then once the player characters reach Absalom Station, they quickly get ambushed by bounty hunters sent by the Golden League. One of the recurring themes of this adventure path is that Edge Corp, specifically Aline Rasora, and the Golden League, specifically the Lord St. John, the Golden League crime boss that you've pissed off, are both sending agents after you and trying to kill you throughout the entire adventure path. Well, Aline had that great assassin that Leo came up with in volume two. So now it's St. John's turn. So now St. John sends some Zune assassins after you. And the only thing I really contributed to this is the setting of where the fight takes place. We knew that the assassins would find the player character somewhere on Absalom Station, but we didn't really know where, and I hate to do an encounter without a map. Like, I really, when we give you an encounter in a Starfighter Adventure, I really want there to be a map for it. So I decided to create this noodles place, and the player characters are walking through, or maybe they're stopping to eat or whatever, and I'm way too proud of naming it the Noodles Between. Of course, it's a riff on the River Between, like this cosmological thing in the Pact Worlds where there's these asteroids that float around the asteroid belt, but there's a way to sort of like move from asteroid to asteroid, and there's this kind of path between the asteroids, and it's a community, like people live on the River Between, and so and you can move from asteroid to asteroid moving along the river. Well, so I mean, you can just imagine how a noodles place would take that, right? Like it would be a bunch of like meatballs or something with noodles connecting all the various asteroids, and they would call themselves Noodles Between, and I am way too proud of this place. So anyway, that's how you got Noodles Between. In a classic Joe bit, like I would never have thought of this in a million years. Tarika asks the players to meet her at a church, at a temple, to Hylax. And so there's this Sheeran there who's like wants to meet everybody and like, you know, befriend them. And it's a great way to bring some Starfinder-ness into the adventure. The Hylax is a very Starfinder specific deity, and the Sheeran and the way that they respond to how friendly they are and their whole personality is a very, very Starfinder-y. And so Tarika meets with you at this temple, and it's like open house night at the temple. And so there's a bunch of other people here from all kinds of different alien species. And it's a way to kind of do the cantina scene, except without being in the cantina. Like it's got 100 different aliens there, but there's no bar and there's no, you know, band playing in the corner, and instead there's a Sheeran with a name tag saying hello, my name is, and he gives everybody one, and everyone has to like meet and greet, and it's a wonderful little role playing bit. Tarika's there, of course, and she's like, you know, trying to not draw attention, And it turned out to be a really interesting scene. It's a great example of things that your writers will come up with that you as a developer had no. I think it just said Tarika meets with the player character somewhere on Absalom Station. Like that was the sentence, right? And everything else from this sequence comes from Joe. And again, he turned it into a job. So the player characters can pick up something on Absalom Station, take it to Entha, and they can get paid in build points for doing so. And this is important because the player characters are leveling up. They have to get build points. Their starship can level up. So we want to keep giving them jobs. And this is a good way to do that. But then, in addition, there's this whole kind of warehouse sequence where, and I don't remember exactly how it was first written. I did some development work on it. But the idea here was that you arrive at the warehouse, and I think we were just kind of doing this is another instance where we had to have a map for it. And I thought, okay, well, there's a warehouse manager and he's way overstressed. This is all Joe stuff. And you come to pick up the cargo, but the cargo is lost and you have to find it. And maybe there's a couple of security robots that are protecting it and you have to overcome them somehow. I decided to add some physicality to this encounter. And I wanted to have like, you're in a warehouse, right? So I thought of like, maybe there's like, because it's all automated. Like, so there's automated tracks along the ceiling that are carrying cargo crates towards the rear. And then there's another track that's carrying cargo out when it's needed. And all of these cargo things are moving and creating interesting terrain for the conflict with the robot. So it's not just a couple of robots guarding a box. So this revolves some conversation back and forth with the editorial team who are like, how does this trap work again? Well, it's not really a trap, but the idea is that these crates are moving forward and back, and the crates that are moving, and they're all like suspended off the ground enough. So you can like, if you're crouching, the things will go over your head. But if you want to, and I don't know if anybody ever will, but that was the hope, you could grab onto one of them and it will carry you really quickly across the map. So if the robot's about to grab you or hug you, because these are all hug bots, these are all like non-lethal, hug you to unconsciousness security robots. If the hug bot's about to grab you, you can like grab onto one of these moving containers and quickly zip to the other side of the map. And now, you know, you can shoot it with your Azimuth laser pistol or whatever. But don't get hit by the moving cargo containers, because those reflex save and you can take damage from, you know, getting clocked by the moving container. It's not a trap, it's a hazard. You guys can tell me if you think that it works. Interestingly, so like I know a lot of people that are playing through Fly Fear Die. A lot of you are doing this on live play. I'm watching your streams or listening to, or I see you post about it on Twitter. And I've really started to get confirmation bias that we did the right thing by slowing down our rate of Adventure Path publication, because nobody's very far in this Adventure Path yet. Like most people are still on volume one, let alone volume two. And I think the final volume is coming out this month, right? Or last month. So we're just putting out adventures too fast. People can't play through the adventure in time. So even though the fact that the entire Adventure Path is out and it's been, you know, a year since I looked at this adventure, no one's played it yet. So I don't really know if this particular hazard works or not. This is an example of a sidebar that I wish we had more of, and I'm so glad we could do it. It lists all kinds of water-related gear that's already in the game. Maybe it's in Armory, maybe it's in the core rulebook, maybe it's somewhere else. And maybe they're magic items, or maybe they're like weapon fusions that you can attach to your gun so that it works well underwater. All of this stuff that players are going to want and GMs are going to want so that they can award this treasure, or the player characters like, okay, we're going to a water planet. What do we need to buy? And they can go shopping and do it quickly and efficiently, because a list of more water stuff than they will ever be able to all afford is already assembled for them in this sidebar, complete with page references. more GM tools. Okay. The middle part of the adventure is when they actually get to Antha. And as soon as they arrive there, they immediately have another moral ethical question. So they arrive and there's a ship trying to get away. It's being chased by Edge Corp blockade ships. And this vessel does not have a drift engine. It's a purely normal space starship. But it's trying to get away, and Edge Corp is chasing it, and they ask you to stop that ship, right? Like, well, who do you side with? Now, it's basically the Edge Corp's word against the captain of this ship's word, and you don't really have a whole lot of evidence one way or the other. So are you going to side with the man? Are you going to side with the corporation? Or are you going to side with the independent starship captain who's like you, right? And Edge Corp is gonna pay you a reward, but the free captain has nothing. Are you going to do what's right, even though it costs you? In this case, it costs you a reward that you don't get to collect. Or are you going to help the corporation that you have quit and that treated you like crap, even though they could pay you credits if you help them? Are you a person of principle, or are you a person, or are you just out for the credits, right? Like, and I wanted to build this issue of this feeling of solidarity with other free captains. The captain of that ship is like you. That could be you in that ship running from the Edge Corp vessel. I haven't talked about that yet, but let's talk about the Edge Corp Negotiator, which is on the interior of this ship, adventure. I love this ship. It's asymmetrical, which feels very Star Wars to me, right? Like a ship that's got this weird layout that's not shaped like a big wedge or like a big oval, like a lot of our starships are. We have this problem because our starships are always presented on this 8.5 by 11 page that often they end up trying to fill the entire page, and they end up like really fat, or they end up like a kind of very similar shape to them all the time. But Joe, who came up with this really interesting and innovative starship design in Dawn of Flame, did it again and gave me this really cool asymmetrical starship design for this volume. Now, it has gotten a little criticism because it's quite a long walk to the bathroom, but you know, it's Edge Corp. It's designed to be dysfunctional. I find this perfectly in character for Edge Corp. The neatest thing about it, though, and this is a totally not immediately observable thing, and player characters might not realize this, is that it's slow. It's slow as shit, right? It's not got a thrust of 4. And what that means is that the player characters can outrun it. And so that's great, because it means that you can escape this thing and not fight it, which I want that option to be true. We talk a lot about creating nonviolent options for conflict resolution. But if the enemy ship has a speed of 12 and you have a speed of 6, you can't not fight that thing. But if it's slow and you're nimble, now you have a choice. Now you have an interesting choice. Do you want to fight the Edge Corp Negotiator because you hate Edge Corp and you have a new weapon you want to test? Or are you can you just outrun it? And I like that. That's not a flaw in the ship. That's a storytelling bonus. Once you get onto the planet, there's this big like settlement there, right? Like the Edge Corp terraforming base. And while you're there, you meet the other important NPCs. You meet Avarin the dragon, who's kind of the boss of this area and the final boss that you can tell from the cover. But you also meet your rivals again. The crew of the Wintermourne return, Neva and Dizzy and Jinx, and I'm forgetting one. And the Witch Warper, I'm forgetting the Witch Warper. But they all are there when you arrive. Okay, now this is stretching credibility. I will make no apologies for this. There is no, there. It's very hard to rationalize the fact that of all the planets in the world you could have gone to, the Wintermorn is also here. I mean, you just left them like not that long ago on another planet, on the prison archipelago back in volume two. But you know what? I don't care, because they're here for, they're thematically and story-wise, I need them to be here. We went into this a little bit with the, we talked about the Wintermorn crew last volume, but the Wintermorn crew is not just here to be like rivals for the player characters. They're not just here to be a bunch of cool NPCs, and they are certainly not intended to upstage the player characters. What they are is a living consequence of the player characters' actions. What the player characters do, the way they comport themselves, influences the way that the Wintermorn crew evolves as characters. If the player characters are fair and trustworthy, if they do things for the right reasons and not just for the money, the Wintermorn crew begins to follow their example, and they become more fair and trustworthy, and they begin to do things for the right reasons and not just for the credits. But if the player characters are just here to backstab and loot, if they treat every potential customer like an ATM machine, and they're just here to take the money and run, well, then the Wintermorn crew is going to take the money and run. And that's their role in the adventure, in the whole campaign. More even than being rivals, although that has a very useful mechanical role, especially in volume two, where the player character is going to get a job and they have to compete against the Wintermorn crew to get the job. Like that's all very useful. But long term, the Wintermorn crew is really there to be a mirror held up to the PCs. And the PCs can see the actions that they take replicated in this Dorian Gray portrait that is the Wintermorn crew. So the Wintermorn crew are there so that at the end of the adventure, when the adventure is over and the player characters have been confronted with a bunch of moral and ethical questions, the choices they made in that become represented in the crew. And there's this whole sequence at the end, and we're skipping ahead a little bit, where the GM is asked to evaluate, did the player characters take the high road? Did they take a low road, or were they somewhere in the middle? Like, were they ethical and moral all the time? Were they unethical and immoral, or were they somewhere in the gray area in the middle? And for every one of the NPCs on the Wintermorn crew, that choice details how the Wintermorn crew treats the player character from that point going forward, right? And it's different for every crew member, because the Wintermorn crew are not all, they're not all good. They're not all evil, right? They've got like one good character. They got one evil character and then a couple of neutrals. And some of them, they all treat the player characters differently based on the moral and ethical choices the player characters made, right? Some of them are going to think the player characters are chumps if they pass up a credit, but others are going to respect them more and bond with them more. So we spend a lot of time setting that up and kind of providing the GM a lot of guidance on how to adjudicate this. How does the crew of the Wintermorn change by the end of this adventure? Even though they're not really in the adventure, they're just there as touchstones for the player characters to meet, talk to, go on the adventure, come back, talk to again, and then the consequences of their actions manifest in the crew. Pretty rapidly, the player characters figure out where Shane is. She's on this deep underwater terraforming platform, and they have to get there. So now they need transportation. There's a couple different ways they can do that. There's a great opportunity here for some underwater combat. They can steal a boat. They can take the tour guide boat. But when they get attacked by people who have their own boats, you can swap your slow, crappy tour guide boat out for that one. And we get a lot of really cool underwater aquatic adventures and vehicles and all that kind of hardware stuff, which is cool. I get to put some showbads in underwater suits. We get the showbad welders. There's something about showbads that made them perfect for this campaign. We used them in volume one too. I think it's because showbads are sort of, they're like, they're working class bad guys, right? They're very they're very useful, and they're not evil. They're just like, you know, they've got a job to do, and they're going to take the money and do the job. They're just great. And so we use them, and ultimately but all of this is leading up to a huge set piece, which is the terraforming installation, which is this, right? So this is the big Abyss reference, because when the players arrive at Terra 5, the terraforming installation, it is flooding. It has suffered a catastrophic accident, and water is pouring into the terraforming installation. And the players are obliged to fix it, to stop the flooding and save the people at the station. And so there's this whole subsystem of as the players move from room to room in the dungeon, what's the flooding level of every room, and how does it increase, and you know, which rooms are open to the water, how can you reduce the flooding, how can you stabilize the whole platform, because the whole thing is like perched on the edge of this big abyssal crater, how do you stop it from falling in, how can you save people from the various rooms, how the whole thing can flood. So I want to give some advice, because when we were editing this, when this was an editorial, Judy was still at Paizo at the time, and she was helping me out with this. She's like, this seems really, really hard. Like, this seems like the players are going to, they're all going to die. Like, the whole base is going to flood, and there's not really much of a chance they can stop it. Here's the thing. Don't open doors you don't have to. Like, keep all the player characters together. Move one group at a time through the base, opening doors when you have to and sealing them behind you when you're done. There's an optional rule in here for tracking all of the individual chambers of the base individually as they all flood on the same time schedule. Don't do that unless you want the adventure to be very hard, right? Don't use the optional rule unless you want it to be very hard. If you want the base adventure, the base difficulty is very doable, but it seems very challenging, and that's good. That's what we want. We want it to seem really hard, but actually be very doable. And the trick to it is that rooms don't flood unless the players are in them. Like, until the player characters get to a room and they open it and they encounter it for the first time, its water level has remained stable as whatever it's set at. When the players get here, this is at flooding level 2 or flooding level 4 or whatever. And so in many ways, the player characters kind of activate each room. That's the way it should be, and that's how this system works. This is all Joe. Joe figured all this out. So as the player characters get to each room, they activate it and it becomes a challenge. How do we stop the flooding here? But as long as you don't keep opening up more doors and opening up more flooding chambers, you can kind of keep it compartmentalized to one chamber at a time, and you can work your way through everything. There are a few various ways to slow the flooding, but ultimately nothing is going to stop the flooding until you seal off every chamber and have the rooms that are open to the water firmly behind bulkhead doors, and then you can pump out everything else, and you'll be left with a large section of the base that is perfectly clean and dry and usable, and then a few rooms that have been open to the water and can't be saved. They can be explored in your swimsuits, in your armor, which all have environmental protections. So you can swim in there and you can explore them, but you can't reconnect them to the rest of the base because they're open to the water, open to the ocean. As the player characters move throughout the base, they encounter the crew and some Kalo mercenaries that have been sent to suppress them. And there's some great role-playing bits and some challenges that are here, but especially the player characters encounter the Aglians for the first time. There's kind of a scientific research room, and in one of them is this room like with one Aglian in it or something. And the player characters have to decide, are they going to let it go, or are they going to try and capture it and study it, or what? Well, that Aglin, of course, goes back and joins with the others. And if the players let it go, then that good act comes back to help them later on as the Aglians recognize them and say, oh, hey, you let one of the 100 Aglians that make up this Aglian, you let the Aglin collective, you let one of them go. You were nice to me. So, you know, I remember that. There's also a lot of other Abyss references. Joe, to Joe's credit, Joe watched the film. Like I told him, like, okay, before you write this adventure, I want you to watch The Abyss. And he did. And, you know, God bless him. He put so much stuff from The Abyss in this thing. So there's a moon pool, and there's a guy with an ROV who's a little crazy. And there's a bunch of great, you know, sort of set pieces from The Abyss that show up in this adventure as interesting encounters. The guy who's gone a little crazy from underwater pressure sickness, but eventually, once you get you have to like stabilize the whole thing and keep it from sliding into the abyss. And once that's all done, you kind of can communicate with Shan and learn why she's here. And she tells the whole deal with the Aglians. And now we have yet another big moral dilemma. You came here to get Shan and get her off the planet, but Shan's like, no, we can't leave yet. Like the Edge Corp is going to destroy this habitat, and they're going to exterminate this entire sapient species for money. Like, they're going to do this for money. We can't let that happen. We have to take action. And Shan won't go without taking this action. Well, if you're mercenaries, you're like, fuck it. We didn't come here for all that. Like, you bonk her on the head, you knock her unconscious, you throw her in your ship, and you leave. And she wakes up in space, mad as hell, right? But if you decide that, yeah, you know, my moral compass points north, I agree, I'm going to help you. Or maybe there's some middle ground where you're like, okay, well, you're really kind of wasting our time here, but I'm not ready to bonk you on the head. So if you refuse to leave, then I guess we have to help you. So we're going to help you, but we're not going to like it. And we're gonna try and get out of here as fast as possible, right? And so you can see that kind of high ground, low ground, middle ground, how it plays out in the course of the adventure. And this all affects the Wintermourne crew by the end. By the way, Shan is my favorite NPC in this campaign. I love this idea of a Berneri in a overalls, you know, who like works it, like a up to her elbows in grease and oil, working on this terraforming platform. When we wrote her up, we gave her stats. Like at first, I don't think she had stat block, but it's very likely that the player characters are going to have Shan with them for much of this adventure. So I thought, well, the GM's going to want her to have a stat block. It's important to remember that NPCs should never overshadow the player characters. And so I gave Shan a bunch of essentially assisting abilities. So for example, she automatically grants supporting fire, where she can automatically aid another. Like you don't have to roll. And so she can just be very helpful. Like, okay, someone's in trouble, so she does supporting fire or covering fire on them. And they don't need to roll, she just does it automatically. And that also makes it very fast and effective. But it's also always supportive rather than actually attacking or doing damage. She can't kill steal anybody. I mean, she could in theory, but she's got all these other abilities that are designed to not do that. I would like to see a lot more characters like this. One of the things that I would like to see in Starfinder is more support for one-on-one or very small groups. Many people play Starfinder. In fact, most people that play Starfinder do it in small groups of less than four players. There's like one GM and one player, or maybe two players or three players. And all of our adventures are too hard for them, or they're designed for four characters. And if you're playing one-on-one or even two people, you don't have all the abilities required to even get through the adventure. It's not just a matter of simply reducing monsters or taking away challenges. It's like, okay, you need to have skills, spells, and combat ability to get through this adventure, and you only got one player or two characters, and they can't cover all those things. They don't have any spellcasters. They don't have an operative. They can't do that. They don't have any healing. So how can we provide tools to allow GMs to play and run one-on-one adventures or adventures for small groups? And one of the ways we could do that would be to include these sort of helper sidekick NPCs who have supportive abilities, like I can provide skills, or I can cast heal, or I can provide you with a magic spell when you need it, or I can even fight for you if you don't want to be the fighter. And I would love to see more characters like that. And Shan is kind of one of my first forays into doing that. It's kind of making a sidekick character. In many ways, this adventure is different than the rest of the adventure path, and it's not what players expect. You end up doing this first contact storyline on a water planet, and you're not getting paid. And it feels very different than Merchants of the Void. Yes, that's by design. That pattern can get very old very fast, and it's very common in adventure paths to have a kind of palate cleanser adventure, where in the middle of the overall story arc, you have like one adventure that's very different than all the others. Even though this is coming quite early, this is the palate cleanser for Fly for Your Die. This is the one adventure that has you doing something that's not for money. And in this case, it's this underwater first contact storyline, the water level. And it's different. It's not what the player character is going to expect. But my hope is that they'll be fish out of water for this adventure, but hopefully they'll still find it enjoyable and interesting. It ends in this sort of climactic battle where Edge Corp's terraforming machine, it's kind of like the Lorax. If you remember the old Dr. Seuss cartoon, there's this machine that's terraforming the planet and it's going to destroy this environment, and the player characters have to sabotage the machine and stop it. Meanwhile, the dragon and her Kalo mercenaries all show up, and she can control the machine. So eventually, like, you know, you end up fighting the machine, but she's using the machine to fight you, and then you can take the machine apart and you still have to fight the dragon. I was very glad that we could do a dragon fight at the end of this adventure. It's climactic. But if you remember early in this diary, and I know we're going quite long today, but I had a lot to talk about, that if you remember early in this diary, I was talking about how the outline did not have as much detail about the various encounters as it probably should have had. And this shows up by the end of this adventure where, you know, you got to win the Aglians' trust, for example, or the Aglians are like, well, we have a bunch of problems and we'd like you to help us solve them. And it can often feel like maybe the player character is kind of going off on these side quests just to get XP, which they need to level up. I'm worried that the player characters will feel like this part of the adventure is unnecessary or that it's over tediously long. I could have outlined this better to give a more clear structure, so we weren't trying to create encounters at the last minute to hit our XP goal. They're all interesting encounters, and there's a lot of great story and role playing potential here. I'm not disappointed in any of them, but it's maybe not as narratively strong as I would have liked. It's like, okay, well, here's a bunch of side quests. Yeah. Okay. Maybe I could have built that into a larger story arc that would have had more of a, it would have felt more integrated. And then we've already dealt with how the adventure ends. You go back, you rescue, you know, after you've defeated the dragon and disassembled her Lorax tree-eating machine, you go back up to the surface and the rival crew, the Wintermourne crew, are there, and your actions determine their future behavior in the rest of the adventure path. And that's kind of it. I've got the other adventures in the path ready to talk about. This adventure ends with the player character with Tarika deciphering important information that the player character stole at the end of volume one, and that will lead us directly into the heist adventure, which is volume four. remember, I've talked about this in various other interviews about this. If the goal of this, if part of the theme of this adventure, the player characters are working class heroes, they're struggling, they're financially struggling. Well, by the end of this adventure, the player characters are seventh level. They're walking around with like thousands of credits worth of gear. And being paid 1,000 credits for something is like small chump change to them by this point. It's actually kind of hard to maintain the feel of working class heroes. And so that meant the adventure path had to change. That means that it could no longer be struggling to pay your bills, because like that's not really a factor anymore. The player character is too high level, and that means that because it's Starfinder, they've got too much money and they're no longer in danger of paying their bills. That pressure is gone. So instead, it's time to hit the next beat. If you remember, the original beat for this whole campaign arc was rags to riches to ruin to revenge. Well, it's time to hit the riches part. They've gone from rags in the first volume. They had their palate cleanser in volume 3 and volume 4. It's time for them to get rich. And all of volume 4 will be about that big. It starts off as a leverage episode. No, it starts off as the train job. It starts off as the train job from Firefly, and it ends as a leverage episode with a long con. The climax is the end of the Blues Brothers, when you're running and everyone in the entire movie is chasing you. So we will get to the White Glove Affair next time. In the meantime, thank you for watching. If you are having to ask me questions, you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Comics, or you can post questions here. I don't often see them very quickly when they're posted to YouTube, but if I do see them, I will answer them. But you can find me faster and easier on Twitter at Dr. Comics. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.